Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from the Treasury of American Short Stories, edited by Nancy Sullivan. Three Heroines by Peter Taylor. Dedicated to the memory of Lily Heth Dabney, another of my heroines. Dressed to the nines, she is 86. A gold lamé gown, savage pearls in her pierced earlobes. Diamonds blazing that her grandmother Haynes wore a century ago, in Washington City, before the war. The exclamations are all mine, not hers, and silent. My questions all silent, too. Who does the woman think she is? Where does she think she's going in that outfit, at her age, in her health? It's not as though I don't know, her son, and she herself doesn't know. And the black maid who dresses her, Willie May, and everybody else who cares at all to, does not know in precisely what plot of cemetery ground this woman will be lying 6 weeks hence at most. Let me do it, says Willie May, about everything, snapping the golden snaps as she stands behind her mistress, towering above her, towering even in heelless carpet slippers. Where does Willie May find such slippers anymore? Pulling the snaps together with her powerful brown hands, pulling the gold cloth over the white powdered back of my beautiful mother. I stand in the doorway watching, waiting in my black tie and dinner jacket, which I have not worn in 10 years until tonight, but which I brought with me on the plane for her sake, at her request. And Willie May, arranging the almost too silvery white mane, silvery, almost like, but not quite like, the blue heads of her less well-bred contemporaries with whom she is reduced to associating. So few of her very own sort are left. The long silvery white hair thinned by time and perhaps by hats. Party hats, shopping hats, church hats, wide-brimmed hats, cloche hats, turbans, whatever the fashion is. But hair thickened tonight, filled in, ratted by Willie till it can deceive even me who remember the old real thickness, the old burnt umber color, everything, how every hair and every strand once grew and fell tenderly and attentively over a child that had mumps or measles and needed attention, and no doubt once upon a time over a lover, a husband. And now Willie May's handsome hands pushing her down onto the dressing table stool like a child. But she is not yielding like a child. Her knees and her hips yield, but her posture is unaffected by standing or sitting. With her long body and short legs, she sits almost as high as she stands. When I remark on this, she says, "A long torso means a long life, plenty of room for all the vital organs." It is one of her jokes. It is something, in fact, that her grandmother Haynes used to say about herself in her late 80s, too, not before the war, in Washington City, but back in Tennessee, the war over, and everything gone but her diamonds, raked from the ashes, and her flat silver, buried and then a year later exhumed, 30 yards northeast, walking in a straight line from the sycamore, and her faded finery, including the black lace mantilla from which she was never parted by war or economic pestilence, proud and witty till the end, that old lady, herself finally buried in the shade of that same sycamore, proud to the end of what she had endured, proud of all she had survived. In her gold lamé, my mother recalls it all and regales us with it one more time, me and Willie May. Seated there on the silk-skirted dressing-table stool, with Willie May kneeling before her, sitting straight as if corseted, which of course she isn't, with the false hair Willie has piled on her head and the false figure just as deceiving, which Willie also has arranged. The dress cut low in front, though not so low as to reveal the old scar from her mastectomy 40 years back when I was 12, the operation that she survived when others were not surviving it. Willie May is massaging her miniature feet, working them into miniature gold slippers, tiny feet but swollen, almost beyond recognition as feet, until they shall be forcibly shod by the firm hand of Willie May. One feels the pain in the room, in one's own feet. But my mother doesn't bat an eye, not a wince from her. Willie hesitates considerately, balancing the right slipper lightly in her gentle palm, looking up questioningly. But mother, not returning the look, says, "Go ahead, please, Willie May." And herself goes ahead with whatever the funny thing is she is saying to me. "There," Willie May says at last, "there you are. We've got you in them. Now you can go to the ball, Cinderella." And to me, Ain't she a pretty thing? Archly, knowing how little I like her to play the black nigger, my mother gazes down at her swollen feet. Ah, she sighs, and then suddenly she's laughing. This is one Cinderella who won't lose a slipper at the ball. We'll have to take them off with the can opener, Willie May. And Willie laughs so hard she has to hide her face in her hands, still squatting there. She rocks back and forth. I think she is laughing. I hope she is laughing. Then her frizzy old wig goes askew on her head, and she throws up her hands to hold it on. She's like a mad woman there on her haunches, her whole body throbbing and shaking, her big hands holding her head on. And Mother sits very erect, watching her. Wearing her most serious expression, she watches Willie May. Now we are standing in the narrow side hall, Mother and I. We are almost on our way. The car and driver are patient outside in the porte-cochere. Suddenly I remember where it is we're going. I never thought we'd really go. Not when she telephoned long distance and asked I come out and play her escort, the golden wedding reception of a couple she hardly knew the names of. Still, it was to be at the club, wasn't it? Everyone would be there, wouldn't they? And I might possibly never go to such a grand affair again. Incredible words, I say to myself. Imagine. But we keep it up, she and I. And now I see the whole evening before me, see just how it will be. Are you sure you want to go, Mother? Are you sure you ought to go after all? I ask with a forced smile, dropping down before her on a straight hall chair. Why, sure she ought to go, cries Willie May, appearing from nowhere, the fairy godmother. Holding wide the silk-lined mink cape, she swoops down on Mother and folds her in the cape. For a moment the leathery brown arms are wrapped about the lighter brown fur like a belt. She holds Mother as if she were a baby in a blanket. She all but kisses her, but doesn't want to spoil the rouged cheek. She says, sure she ought to go. My darling's going to have the time of her life. Now I am on my feet again. Mother stares up at me with eyes bright as a child's. The coloring of her rouge and lipstick seems real, more than real as a doll's coloring. She is more real than life. She is something Willie May has put together to amuse a sick child with. It is such a party as one goes to in one's dreams, that is, in nightmares of a milder sort. At most there are six faces in all the vast clutter of faces which I think that I can match with names, and in half that number it is the wrong name I actually come up with. Yet sticking like pitch to Mother, I'm smiled upon by everyone. A faithful son at such an affair as this is everybody's hero. And my beautiful Mother is everybody's heroine. They flock to her and stand about listening to her famous bon mot, her jokes, her stories. When it is crudely suggested by someone that she might be the oldest person present, she says, I don't mind being old. There's just no future in it. A moment's hush, then a burst of laughter. Dear lady, with your high-piled silver tresses and your golden draperies, you are like a Greek goddess mingling tonight amongst the mere mortals of the country club. He is some old professor emeritus from the university, or so someone whispers in my ear. I feel myself blushing. She blinks at him twice or three times, and then, after only a moment's reflection, as to my golden draperies, Greek accusative Herr Professor, they are, of course, in honor of the occasion, bought new for our dear friend's wedding anniversary. Something old, that's me. Something new, that's the dress. Something borrowed, that's my son's strength. Something blue, that's the hair piled so high on my old head. She is the belle of the ball without rival. Everyone comes playing homage to her, almost everyone. Only her medicine man, as she calls him, her beloved doctor, keeps his distance. He whom we met on the steps outside the club and had our exchanges with, brief and awkward, out there in the vestibule. I see him eyeing her from far across the room and again from a nearer point, eyeing her with dark, deep-set eyes out of his long, sad face. Twice, at least, I see him moving toward her. He is a man my age. I watch him closely. Each time he approaches us, he lets himself be intercepted, averted, drawn aside. How easily he permits it. How eagerly he greets those who intercept him and keep him from us, from her. They, too, no doubt, are his aging patients. But to my mother he will not come, never. And of course I have known all along he would not. From the moment I saw his face in the dim light on the outside steps, I knew. He looked at her as though he had seen a ghost. He could not believe his eyes. She, at such an affair, dressed to the nines, with what she had inside her? He gave no sign of recognition. This woman who resembled his dying patient, whom he regarded as already dead, really, he would be a fool to mistake the one for the other. Then, face to face with her, in the bright light of the vestibule, his curt greeting to her is all but insulting. He cannot help it, though. He wishes only to turn, with his knowledge, back into the uncertain dimness of the steps outside, and on back into the blissful darkness of his primitive profession. What does he know of death? Certainly nothing at all, he says to himself. He knows only about the cessation of life. She must not ask him to go beyond that with her. The terror seen in the eyes of most patients is no less repulsive to him than its opposite, whatever the opposite might be called. There can be no proper greeting for death. There can be no attitude at all toward death. If there is any real way of dealing with death, says her beloved doctor to himself, then all his success at preventing and relieving pain, even at saving life, is such a small thing, hardly worth considering by comparison. But the beloved doctor could not turn back into the dimness, and he could not brush past my mother in the vestibule. For one awful moment his eyes met mine. All that could pass between us was our disbelief. I don't know of what precisely, and I don't know which of us pitied the other more. And then the arriving guests pushed us on inside and into the party and parted us, and the evening became an eternity in which the stricken doctor could not even manage, could not bring himself to say good night to mother. Home at last, though, she had done it. In the car, sitting together in the back seat, she held my hand tight, never slackening all the way, a kind of thing she hadn't done in years. And then only when I was in trouble, when I was waiting to face father over my newest act of rebellion or my latest incompetence. The clasp of the hand brings it all back. My foolish first marriage that wasn't really a marriage, flunking out of college, hitchhiking to the Gulf Coast, shipping out workaway on a waterman line freighter, never writing them a word about where I was, then rolling in home in dirty clothes and too drunk to speak, and finally, worst of all, deserting to the literati. And then, at last, forgiveness. Father forgiving me because he was dying. Tears streaming down his cheeks, his only words since he could no longer speak. Me forgiving father because he was dying. Myself speechless, too. Mother forgiving both and saying there was nothing to forgive. But all the way home she holds my hand and talks again of her grandmother Haynes. Only of her grandmother Haynes. Of her bravery during the war, her husband on the Union side, off lecturing at Boston and Philadelphia, raising money to relieve the suffering of loyalist upcountry Southerners, and her own twin brother, the Confederate senator, his musical voice and old-fashioned rhetoric resounding through the halls of the Capitol at Richmond. She adored them both, husband and brother, wrote each of them a letter every day that passed, and suffered for them both. Staying at home with the 11 children and the freed slaves, persecuted by her neighbors on both sides, accused by each side of supporting the other, even of spying, of sending information from Boston to Richmond, and from Richmond to Boston, and so on to Washington. Two of her children died, and one freed slave went berserk, thought he was Jeff Davis, and tried to surrender to everybody. But she, Grandmother Haynes, never surrendered to either side, and never betrayed either side. She looked after her children, ran the farm, and gave a dance in the parlor at least once a month. People said she was vain and frivolous. She was, most assuredly, both, and capable and hard-working and brave, too. Toward the end of the war, sometime during the last weeks of it, her neighbors burned the house and barn and even set fire to the summer kitchen and the smokehouse. Then her husband, Grandfather Haynes, came down and took her and the children through the lines to Princeton. It's a pretty place, she wrote her brother. To see it, you wouldn't suppose there had been a war. But now the war was over. She and Grandfather Haynes and the children had to go back to Tennessee and be poor as church mice. They were as poor as if Grandfather Haynes had been on the losing side. All she had was her flat silver and her diamonds and her faded finery. They say she wore her black lace mantilla to do the milking in, and her brocades and silks to hoe corn and chop cotton. Her husband turned Methodist and took up preaching seriously, preaching religion to the Covites and to the mountain folks and the black Republicans, who were in sore need of it, his wife pronounced. But she approved. It's doing good where good is needed, she said. Besides, there's more money in preaching than in farming nowadays. One day her brother, the twin, his whereabouts unknown to her for more than a year, appeared in the cowshed doorway in his cutaway and starched shirt front, his silk hat in his hand. He had been to Brazil. He was on his way out west now to make a new beginning, traveling under an assumed name, Ben Smith. "What a pity," she said to him, "to have to be known as Ben Smith the rest of your life when you are really Landon Carter of Tennessee." They embraced, shedding tears for their happy reunion, as she reported it, and then parted without tears, but with long looks as he retreated on foot out of the barn lot and down the valley road, both of them knowing they would never meet again in this life. "Home at last, yes, and I have almost forgotten whether it is my mother I am with or my great-grandmother Haynes, though I have heard it all recited before, time and again, and in the same words, it never seems so real. The two women never seem so nearly one. Franklin, her driver, is at her other elbow. Together we very nearly carry her inside. She was vain and frivolous and brave, Mother says, as much to Franklin as to me. Franklin knows the stories, too. He and the good doctor together have been more son to her than I in these last years. It is a combination people find it hard to understand, but they shouldn't. It's not uncommon, do you think? Willie is waiting in the lighted doorway. We traverse that last 10 feet under the porte cochere and across the porch. As we make our way with her, it comes over me how near the end she is. More than that, it sweeps over me how little even there has been in her life. Wars have raged always on the other side of the world for her. She has not even had to choose between neighbors or not choose. She did not even have a twin brother to be torn away from, or an idealistic and practical husband to stand behind. Hers was faithful, adoring, and a good provider. Her only child never even gave her a scare, not of dying anyway. Even his rebellions and desertions and incompetences were healthy in their way. But what is evident somehow is that she is every bit the heroine she would have been had she been called upon to show her colors. She has always been ready and would have been up to whatever might have come. And all this she knows. She knows. Yet she is not jaded or disappointed at not having had her chance to show. And that, what is that? Why, that is better than having shown. It is something more than life. Death doesn't exist for it, beloved doctor. Just inside the door to the side hall, Willie is waiting. She does not take one step forward. She waits in her self-appointed place for us to deliver our charge. She does not even open her arms until we are in the doorway and standing before her. Then she throws wide her arms and clasps her mistress to her bosom as though she were herself the angel waiting on the other side. "My honey, my darling," she says, hugging her, petting her, and I hear Mother's muffled voice. "Willie May, I'm so tired." "Of course, sure you are," says Willie May. I stand there beside Franklin, feeling empty-handed. There's nothing else for me to do. "I'll put up the car," says Franklin. He is lucky. And he leaves me alone with just Mother and Willie May. Maybe she ought not to have gone after all, I say, not knowing anything else to say. "She had to go," Willie says. "I think she had a wonderful time," I say, not thinking of anything else to say. "Of course she had a wonderful time," says Willie, still holding Mother, and looks at me over Mother's head, as if to say, "What else did you expect of her?" "Anyway, I'm glad you waited up for her," I say. And Willie, with a look of even deeper wonder, asks with her eyes, "What else did you expect of me?" And that story was Three Heroines by Peter Taylor from the Treasury of American Short Stories, edited by Nancy Sullivan. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from Great Short Stories of the World, selected by the editors of Reader's Digest. The Brute by Joseph Conrad. Dodging in from the rain-swept street, I exchanged a smile and a glance with Miss Blank in the bar of the Three Crows. This exchange was effected with extreme propriety. It is a shock to think that, if still alive, Miss Blank must be something over 60 now. How time passes! Noticing my gaze directed at the partition of glass and varnished wood, Miss Blank was good enough to say encouragingly, "Only Mr. German and Mr. Stoner in the parlor with another gentleman I've never seen before." I moved toward the parlor door. A voice discoursing on the other side rose so loudly that the concluding words became quite plain in all their atrocity. That fellow Wilmot fairly dashed her brains out, and a good job, too. As I opened the parlor door, the same voice went on in the same cruel strain. I was glad when I heard she got the knock from somebody at last. Sorry enough for poor Wilmot, though. That man and I used to be chums at one time. Of course, that was the end of him. A clear case, if there ever was one. No way out of it, none at all. The voice belonged to the gentleman Miss Blank had never seen before. He straddled his long legs on the hearthrug. German, leaning forward, held his pocket handkerchief spread out before the grate. He looked back dismally over his shoulder, and as I slipped behind one of the little wooden tables, I nodded to him. On the other side of the fire sat Mr. Stonar, jammed tight into a capacious Windsor armchair. There was nothing small about him but his short white side whiskers. A man's handbag of the usual size looked like a child's toy on the floor near his feet. I did not nod to him. He was too big to be nodded to in that parlor. He was a senior Trinity pilot and condescended to take his turn in the cutter only during the summer months. Besides, it's no use nodding to a monument. And he was like one. He didn't speak. He didn't budge. He just sat there holding his handsome old head up, immovable and almost bigger than life. It was extremely fine. Mr. Stoner's presence reduced poor old German to a mere shabby wisp of a man and made the talkative stranger in tweeds on the hearthrug look absurdly boyish. I was glad of it, this man repeated emphatically. You may be surprised, but then you haven't gone through the experience I've had of her. I can tell you it was something to remember. Of course, I got off scot-free myself, as you can see. She did her best to break up my pluck for me, though. She jolly near drove as fine a fellow as ever lived into a madhouse. What do you say to that, eh? Not an eyelid twitched in Mr. Stoner's enormous face. Monumental, the speaker looked straight into my eyes. It used to make me sick to think of her going about the world murdering people. German held the handkerchief a little nearer to the grate and groaned. It was simply a habit he had. She had a house, he declared, a great big ugly white thing. You could see it from miles away, sticking up. So you could, assented the other readily. It was the old Colchester's notion, though he was always threatening to give her up. He couldn't stand her racket any more. I dare say he would have chucked her, only, it may surprise you, his missus wouldn't hear of it. Funny, eh? But with women you never know how they will take a thing, and Mrs. Colchester, with her mustaches and big eyebrows, set up for being as strong-minded as they make them. You should have heard her snapping out, "Rubbish! Or stuff and nonsense!" I dare say she knew when she was well off. They had no children and had never set up a home anywhere. When in England she just made shift to hang out anyhow in some cheap hotel or boarding-house. I dare say she liked to get back to the comfort she was used to. She knew very well she couldn't gain by any change. Anyhow, for one reason or another, it was rubbish and stuff and nonsense for the good lady. I overheard once young Mr. Apps himself say to her confidentially, "I assure you, Mrs. Colchester, I'm beginning to feel quite unhappy about the name she's getting for herself." "Oh," says she, with her deep little hoarse laugh, "if one took notice of all the silly talk," and she showed Apps all her ugly false teeth at once. "It would take more than that to make me lose my confidence in her, I assure you," says she. At this point, without any change of facial expression, Mr. Stoner emitted a short, sardonic laugh. It was very impressive, but I didn't see the fun. I looked from one to another. The stranger on the hearthrug had an ugly smile, and Mr. Apps shook both Mrs. Colchester's hands. He was so pleased to hear a good word said for their favorite. All these Appses, young and old, you know, were perfectly infatuated with that abominable, dangerous— "I beg your pardon," I interrupted, for he seemed to be addressing himself exclusively to me. "But who on earth are you talking about?" "I'm talking of the Apps family," he answered courteously. I nearly let out a damn at this, but just then the respected Miss Blank put her head in and said that the cab was at the door if Mr. Stoner wanted to catch the 11:03 up. At once the senior pilot rose in his mighty bulk and began to struggle into his coat. The stranger and I hurried impulsively to his assistance, and directly we laid our hands on him, he became perfectly quiescent. We had to raise our arms very high and to make efforts. It was like caparisoning a docile elephant. With a "Thanks, gentlemen," he dived under and squeezed himself through the door in a great hurry. We smiled at each other in a friendly way. "Are you a sailor?" I asked the stranger, who had gone back to his position on the rug. "I used to be till a couple of years ago, when I got married," he answered. I even went to sea first in that very ship we were speaking of when you came in. What ship? I asked, puzzled. I never heard you mention a ship. I've just told you her name, my dear sir, he replied. The Apps family. Surely you've heard of the great firm of Apps and Sons, ship owners. They had a pretty big fleet. There was the Lucy Apps and the Harold Apps and Anne, John, Malcolm, Clara, Juliet, and so on. No end of Appses. Every brother, sister, aunt, cousin, wife, and grandmother, too, for all I know, of the firm had a ship named after them. Good, solid, old-fashioned craft they were, too, built to carry and to last. None of your newfangled labor-saving appliances in them. This last one, he continued, the Apps family, was to be like the others, only she was to be still stronger, still safer, still more roomy and comfortable. I believe they meant her to last forever. They had her built composite, iron, teakwood, and greenheart, and her scantling was something fabulous. If ever an order was given for a ship in a spirit of pride, this one was. Everything of the best. The Commodore captain of the employ was to command her, and they planned the accommodation for him like a house on shore under a big tall poop that went nearly to the mainmast. No wonder Mrs. Colchester wouldn't let the old man give her up. The fuss that was made while that ship was building, let's have this a little stronger and that a little heavier, and hadn't that other thing better be changed for something a little thicker. The builders entered into the spirit of the game, and there she was, growing into the clumsiest, heaviest ship of her size right before all their eyes, without anybody becoming aware of it somehow. She was to be 2,000 tons register, or a little over, no less on any account. But when they came to measure her, she turned out 1,999 tons in a fraction. They say old Mr. Apps was so annoyed when they told him that, that he took to his bed and died. The old gentleman was 96 years old, if a day, so his death wasn't perhaps so surprising. Still, Mr. Lucian Apps was convinced that his father would have lived to 100. So we may put the old man at the head of the list. Next comes the poor devil of a shipwright that brute caught and squashed as she went off the ways. They called it a ship launching, but I've heard people say that from the wailing and yelling and scrambling out of the way, it was more like letting a devil loose upon the river. She snapped all her checks like pack thread and went for the tugs in an attendance like a fury. Before anybody could see what she was up to, she sent one of them to the bottom and laid up another for 3 months' repairs. One of her cables parted, and then suddenly, you couldn't tell why, she let herself be brought up with the other as quiet as a lamb. That's how she was. You can never be sure what she would be up to next. There are ships difficult to handle, but generally you can depend on them behaving rationally. With that ship, whatever you did with her, you never knew how it would end. She was a wicked beast, or perhaps she was only just insane. He uttered this supposition in so earnest a tone that I could not refrain from smiling. He left off biting his lower lip to apostrophize me. Eh? Why not? Why couldn't there be something in her build, in her lines corresponding to madness? Why shouldn't there be a mad ship, I mean mad in a ship-like way, so that under no circumstances could you be sure she would do what any other sensible ship would naturally do for you? She was unaccountable. If she wasn't mad, then she was one of the most evil-minded, underhanded, savage brute that ever went afloat. I've seen her run into a heavy gale beautifully for 2 days, and on the third broach to twice in the same afternoon. The first time she flung the helmsman clean over the wheel, but as she didn't quite manage to kill him, she had another try about 3 hours afterwards. She swamped herself fore and aft, burst all the canvas we had set, scared all hands into a panic, and even frightened Mrs. Colchester down there in these beautiful stern cabins that she was so proud of. When we mustered the crew, there was one man missing. Swept overboard, of course, without being either seen or heard, poor devil, and I only wonder more of us didn't go. Always something like that, always. You could never be certain what would hold her. On the slightest provocation, she would start snapping ropes, cables, wire hawsers, like carrots. She was heavy, clumsy, unhandy, but that does not quite explain the power for mischief she had. He looked at me inquisitively, but of course I couldn't admit that a ship could be mad. In the ports where she was known, he went on, they dreaded the sight of her. She thought nothing of knocking away 20 feet or so of solid stone facing off a quay or wiping off the end of a wooden wharf. She must have lost miles of chain and hundreds of tons of anchors in her time. When she fell aboard some poor, unoffending ship, it was the very devil of a job to haul her off again. And she never got hurt herself, just a few scratches or so, perhaps. They had wanted to have her strong, and so she was, strong enough to ram polar ice with. And as she began, so she went on. From the day she was launched, she never let a year pass without murdering somebody. I think the owners got very worried about it, but they were a stiff-necked generation, all these Appses. They wouldn't admit there could be anything wrong with the Apps family. They wouldn't even change her name. Stuff and nonsense, as Mrs. Colchester used to say. They ought to at least have shut her up for life in some dry dock or other, away up the river, and never let her smell salt water again. I assure you, my dear sir, that she invariably did kill someone every voyage she made. It was perfectly well known. She got a name for it, far and wide. I expressed my surprise that a ship with such a deadly reputation could ever get a crew. Then you don't know what sailors are, my dear sir. Recklessness. A vanity of boasting in the evening to all their chums. We've just shipped in that there Apps family. Blow her! She ain't going to scare us. Sheer sailor-like perversity. A sort of curiosity. Well, a little of all that, no doubt. But I tell you what, there was a sort of fascination about the brute. German, who seemed to have seen every ship in the world, broke in sulkily. I saw her once out of this very window, towing up river, a great black ugly thing, going along like a big hearse. Something sinister about her looks, wasn't there, said the man in tweeds, looking down at old German with a friendly eye. I always had a sort of horror of her. She gave me a beastly shock when I was no more than 14, the very first day, nay, hour, I joined her. Father came to see me off and was to go down to Gravesend with us. I was his second boy to go to sea. My big brother was already an officer then. We got on board about 11 in the morning and found the ship ready to drop out of the basin, stern first. She had not moved 3 times her own length when, at a little pluck the rug gave her to enter the dock gates, she made one of her rampaging starts and put such a weight on the check rope, a new 6-inch hawser, that forward there they had no chance to ease it round in time, and it parted. I saw the broken end fly up high in the air, and the next moment that brute brought her quarter against the pierhead with a jar that staggered everybody about her decks. She didn't hurt herself, not she. But one of the boys the mate had sent aloft on the mizzen to do something came down on the poop deck, thump, right in front of me. He was not much older than myself. We had been grinning at each other only a few minutes before. He must have been handling himself carelessly, not expecting to get such a jerk. I heard his startled cry, "Oh!" in a high treble as he felt himself going, and looked up in time to see him go limp. He fell within 2 feet of me, cracking his head on a mooring bit. Never moved. Stone dead. Ugh! Poor father was remarkably white about the gills when we shook hands in Gravesend. "Are you all right?" he says, looking hard at me. "Yes, father." "Quite sure?" "Yes, father." "Well, then, goodbye, my boy." He told me afterwards that for half a word he would have carried me off home with him there and then. "I'm the baby of the family, you know," he added with an ingenuous smile. I acknowledged this interesting communication by a sympathetic murmur. He waved his hand carelessly. This might have utterly spoiled a chap's nerve for going aloft, you know, utterly. However, that wasn't yet the worst that brute of a ship could do. I served in her 3 years of my time, and then I got transferred to the Lady Apps for a year. To me, who had known no ship but the Apps family, the Lucy was like a sort of magic craft that did what you wanted her to do of her own accord. Well, I finished my last year of apprenticeship in that jolly little ship, and then just as I was thinking of having 3 weeks of real good time on shore, I got at breakfast a letter asking me the earliest day I could be ready to join the Apps family as a third mate. I gave my plate a shove that shot it to the middle of the table. Dad looked up over his paper, Mother raised her hands in astonishment, and I went out bareheaded into our bit of garden where I walked around and round for an hour. When I came in again, Mother was out of the dining room, and Dad had shifted berth into his big armchair. The letter was lying on the mantelpiece. "It's very creditable to you to get that offer, and very kind of them to make it," he said. "And I see also that Charles has been appointed chief mate of that ship for one voyage." There was, Overleaf, a P.S. to that effect in Mr. Apps's own handwriting, which I had overlooked. Charlie was my big brother. I don't like very much to have two of my boys together in one ship, Father went on in his solemn way, and I may tell you that I would not mind writing Mr. Apps a letter to that effect. Dear old Dad, he was a wonderful father. What would you have done? The mere notion of going back, and as an officer, too, to be worried and bothered, and kept on the jump night and day by that brute, made me feel sick. But she wasn't a ship that you could afford to fight shy of. Besides, the most genuine excuse could not be given without mortally offending absent sons. This was a case for answering, ready now from your very deathbed if you wish to die in their good graces. And that's precisely what I did answer, by wire, to have it over and done with at once. The prospect of being shipmates with my big brother cheered me considerably, though it made me a bit anxious, too. Ever since I remember myself as a little chap, he had been very good to me, and I looked upon him as the finest fellow in the world. And so he was. No better officer ever walked the deck of a merchant ship. He was a fine, strong, upstanding, sun-tanned young fellow, with his brown hair curling a little and an eye like a hawk. He was just splendid. We hadn't seen each other for many years, and even this time, though he had been in England 3 weeks already, he hadn't showed up at home yet, but had spent his spare time in Surrey somewhere making up to Maggie Colchester, old Captain Colchester's niece. Her father, a great friend of Dad's, was in the sugar-broking business, and Charlie made a sort of second home of their house. I wondered what my big brother would think of me. He received me with a great shout of laughter. He seemed to think my joining as an officer the greatest joke in the world. There was a difference of 10 years between us, and I was a kid of 4 when he first went to sea. It surprised me to find how boisterous he could be. "Now we shall see what you are made of," he cried, and punched my ribs and hustled me into his berth. "Sit down, Ned. I'm glad of the chance of having you with me. I'll put the finishing touch to you, my young officer, providing you're worth the trouble. And first of all, get it well into your head that we are not going to let this brute kill anybody this voyage. We'll stop her racket." I perceived he was in dead earnest about it. He talked grimly of the ship and how we must be careful and never allow this ugly beast to catch us napping with any of her damned tricks. He gave me a regular lecture on special seamanship for the use of the Apps family. Then, changing his tone, he began to talk at large, rattling off the wildest, funniest nonsense, till my sides ached with laughing. I could see he was a bit above himself with high spirits. It couldn't be because of my coming, not to that extent, but it was all made plain enough a day or two afterwards when I heard that Miss Maggie Colchester was coming for the voyage. Uncle was giving her a sea trip for the benefit of her health. I don't know what could have been wrong with her health. She had a beautiful color and a deuce of a lot of fair hair. She didn't care a rap for wind or rain or spray or sun or green seas or anything. She was a blue-eyed, jolly girl of the very best sort, but the way she checked my big brother used to frighten me. I always expected it to end in an awful row. However, nothing decisive happened till after we'd been in Sydney for a week. One day in the men's dinner hour, Charlie sticks his head into my cabin. I was stretched out on my back on the settee, smoking in peace. "Come ashore with me, Ned," he says in his curt way. I jumped up, of course, and away after him down the gangway and up George Street. He strode along like a giant, and I at his elbow, panting. It was confoundedly hot. "Where on earth are you rushing me to, Charlie?" I made bold to ask. "Here," he says. Here was a jeweler's shop. I couldn't imagine what he could want there. It seemed a sort of mad freak. He thrust under my nose 3 rings, which looked very tiny on his big brown palm, growling out, "For Maggie, which?" I got a kind of scare at this. I couldn't make a sound, but I pointed at the one that sparkled white and blue. He put it in his waistcoat pocket, paid for it with a lot of sovereigns, and bolted out. When we got on board, I was quite out of breath. "Shake hands, old chap," I gasped out. He gave me a thump on the back. "Give what orders you like to the boatswain when the hands turn to," says he. "I'm off duty this afternoon." Then he vanished from the deck for a while, but presently he came out of the cabin with Maggie, and these two went over to the gangway publicly, before all hands, going for a walk together on that awful blazing hot day, with clouds of dust flying about. They came back after a few hours, looking very staid, but didn't seem to have the slightest idea where they had been. Anyway, that's the answer they both made to Mrs. Colchester's questions at tea-time. As you may imagine, the fiendish propensities of that cursed ship were never spoken of on board. Not in the cabin, at any rate. Only once on the homeward passage Charlie said, incautiously, something about bringing all her crew home this time. Captain Colchester began to look uncomfortable at once, and Mrs. Colchester, that silly, hard-bitten old woman, flew out at Charlie as though he had said something indecent. I was quite confounded myself. As to Maggie, she sat completely mystified, opening her blue eyes very wide. Of course, before she was a day older, she wormed it all out of me. She was a very difficult person to lie to. "How awful," she said, quite solemn. "So many poor fellows. I'm glad the voyage is nearly over. I won't have a moment's peace about Charlie now." I assured her Charlie was all right. It took more than that ship knew to get over a seaman like Charlie, and she agreed with me. Next day we got the tug off Dungeness, and when the tow rope was fast, Charlie rubbed his hands and said to me in an undertone, "We've baffled her, Ned." "Looks like it," I said, with a grin at him. It was beautiful weather, and the sea as smooth as a mill pond. We went up the river without a shadow of trouble, except once, when off Hole Haven, the brute took a sudden sheer and nearly had a barge anchored just clear of the fairway. But I was aft, looking after the steering, and she did not catch me napping that time. Charlie came up on the poop, looking very concerned. "Close shave," says he. "Never mind, Charlie," I answered cheerily. "You've tamed her." We were to tow right up to the dock. The river pilot boarded us below Gravesend, and the first words I heard him say were, "You may just as well take your port anchor inboard at once, Mr. Mate." This had been done when I went forward. I saw Maggie on the forecastle head enjoying the bustle, and I begged her to go aft, but she took no notice of me, of course. Then Charlie, who was very busy with the headgear, caught sight of her and shouted in his biggest voice, "Get off the forecastle head, Maggie! You're in the way here!" For an answer, she made a funny face at him, and I saw poor Charlie turn away, hiding a smile. She was flushed with the excitement of getting home again, and her blue eyes seemed to snap electric sparks as she looked at the river. A collier brig had gone round just ahead of us, and our tug had to stop her engines in a hurry to avoid running into her. In a moment, as is usually the case, all the shipping in the reach seemed to get into a hopeless tangle. A schooner and a ketch got up a small collision all to themselves right in the middle of the river. It was exciting to watch, and meantime our tug remained stopped. Any other ship than that brute could have been coaxed to keep straight for a couple of minutes. But not she. Her head fell off at once, and she began to drift down, taking her tug along with her. I noticed a cluster of coasters at anchor within a quarter of a mile of us, and I thought I had better speak to the pilot. "If you let her get amongst that lot," I said quietly, "she will grind some of them into bits before we get her out again." "Don't I know her," cries he, stamping his foot in a perfect fury, and he out with his whistle to make that bothered tug get the ship's head up again as quick as possible. He blew like mad, waving his arm to port, and presently we could see that the tug's engines had been set going ahead. Her paddles churned the water, but it was as if she had been trying to tow a rock. She couldn't get an inch out of that ship. Again the pilot blew his whistle and waved his arm to port. We could see the tug's paddles turning faster and faster away, broad on our bow. For a moment, tug and ship hung motionless in a crowd of moving shipping, and then the terrific strain that evil, stony-hearted brute would always put on everything tore the towing chock clean out. The tow rope surged over, snapping the iron stanchions of the head rail one after another as if they had been sticks of sealing wax. It was only then I noticed that in order to have a better view over our heads, Maggie had stepped upon the port anchor as it lay flat on the forecastle deck. It had been lowered properly into its hardwood beds, but there had been no time to take a turn with it. Anyway, it was quite secure as it was for going into dock, but I could see directly that the tow rope would sweep under the fluke in another second. My heart flew up right into my throat, but not before I had time to yell out, "Jump clear of that anchor!" But I hadn't had time to shriek out her name. I don't suppose she heard me at all. The first touch of the hawser against the fluke threw her down. She was up on her feet again, quick as lightning, but she was up on the wrong side. I heard a horrid scraping sound, and then that anchor, tipping over, rose up like something alive. Its great, rough iron arm caught Maggie round the waist, seemed to clasp her close with a dreadful hug, and flung itself with her over and down into a terrific clang of iron, followed by heavy ringing blows that shook the ship from stem to stern, because the ring stopper held. "How horrible!" I exclaimed. "I used to dream for years afterwards of anchors catching hold of girls," said the man in tweeds a little wildly. He shuddered. With a most pitiful howl, Charlie was over after her almost on the instant. But, Lord, he didn't see as much as a gleam of her red tam-o'-shanter in the water. Nothing! Nothing whatever! In a moment there were half a dozen boats around us, and he got pulled into one. I, with the boatswain and the carpenter, let go the other anchor in a hurry and brought the ship up somehow. The pilot had gone silly. He walked up and down the forecastle head, wringing his hands and muttering to himself, "Killing women now! Killing women now!" Not another word could you get out of him. Dusk fell, then a night black as pitch, and peering upon the river I heard a lone, mournful hail, "Ship ahoy!" Two Gravesend watermen came alongside. They had a lantern in their wherry and looked up the ship's side, holding on to the ladder without a word. I saw in the patch of light a lot of loose fair hair down there. He shuddered again. After the tide turned, poor Maggie's body had floated clear of one of them big mooring buoys, he explained. I crept aft, feeling half dead, and managed to send a rocket up to let the other searchers know on the river. And then I slunk away forward like a cur and spent the night sitting on the heel of the bowsprit so as to be as far as possible out of Charlie's way. "Poor fellow," I murmured. "Yes, poor fellow," he repeated musingly. "That brute wouldn't let him, not even him, cheat her of her prey. But he made her fast in dock next morning. He did." We hadn't exchanged a word, not a single look for that matter. I didn't want to look at him. When the last rope was fast, he put his hands to his head and stood gazing down at his feet as if trying to remember something. The men waited on the main deck for the words that end the voyage. Perhaps that is what he was trying to remember. I spoke for him. "That'll do, men." I never saw a crew leave a ship so quietly. They sneaked over the rail one after another, taking care not to bang their sea chests too heavily. They looked our way, but not one had the stomach to come up and offer to shake hands with the mate as is usual. I followed him all over the empty ship to and fro, here and there, with no living soul about but the two of us, because the old shipkeeper had locked himself up in the galley, both doors. Suddenly poor Charlie mutters in a crazy voice, "I'm done here," and strides down the gangway with me at his heels, up the dock, out at the gate, on towards Tower Hill. The man in tweeds nodded at me significantly. Ah, there was nothing that could be done with that brute. She had a devil in her. "Where's your brother?" I asked, expecting to hear he was dead. But he was commanding a smart steamer on the China coast and never came home now. Jermyn fetched a heavy sigh, and the handkerchief being now sufficiently dry, put it up tenderly to his red and lamentable nose. "She was a ravening beast," the man in tweeds started again. "Old Colchester put his foot down and resigned. And would you believe it? Absent Sons wrote to ask whether he wouldn't reconsider his decision. Anything to save the good name of the Apps family. Old Colchester went to the office then and said he would take charge again, but only to sail her out into the North Sea and scuttle her there. He was nearly off his chump. He used to be darkish iron gray, but his hair went snow white in a fortnight. They jumped at the first man they could get to take her, for fear of the scandal of the Apps family not being able to find a skipper. He was a festive soul, I believe, but he stuck to her grim and hard. Wilmot was his second mate, a harum-scarum fellow and pretending to a great scorn for all the girls. The fact is, he was really timid. But let only one of them do as much as lift her little finger in encouragement, and there was nothing that could hold the beggar. It was said that one of the firm had been heard once to express a hope that this brute of a ship would get lost soon. But not she. She was going to last forever. She had a nose to keep off the bottom. Jermyn made a grunt of approval. "A ship after a pilot's own heart, eh?" jeered the man in tweeds. "Well, Wilmot managed it. He was the man for it, but even he, perhaps, couldn't have done the trick without the green-eyed governess, or nurse, or whatever she was to the children of Mr. and Mrs. Pamphilius. Those people were passengers in her from Port Adelaide to the Cape. Well, the ship went out and anchored outside for the day. The skipper, hospitable soul, had a lot of guests from town to a farewell lunch, as usual with him. It was 5 in the evening before the last shore boat left the side, and the weather looked ugly and dark in the gulf. There was no reason for him to get under way. However, as he had told everybody he was going that day, he imagined it was proper to do so anyhow. But as he had no mind, after all these festivities, to tackle the straits in the dark, he gave orders to keep the ship under lower topsails and foresail as close as she would lie, dodging along the land till the morning. Then he sought his couch. The mate was on deck, having his face washed very clean with hard rain squalls. Wilmot relieved him at midnight. The Apps family had, as you observed, a house on her poop. "A big, ugly white thing sticking up," Jermyn murmured sadly at the fire. "That's it, a companion for the cabin stairs and a sort of chart room combined." The rain drove in gusts on the sleepy Wilmot. The ship was then surging slowly to the southward, close-hauled, with the coast within 3 miles or so to windward. There was nothing to look out for in that part of the gulf, and Wilmot went round to dodge the squalls under the lee of that chart room, whose door on that side was open. The night was black, like a barrel of coal tar, and then he heard a woman's voice whispering to him. That confounded green-eyed girl of the Pamphilius people had put the kids to bed a long time ago, of course, but it seems couldn't get to sleep herself, and she came up into the chart room to cool herself, I dare say. I suppose when she whispered to Wilmot it was as if somebody had struck a match in the fellow's brain. I don't know how it was they had got so very thick. I fancy he had met her ashore a few times before. I couldn't make it out, because when telling the story, Wilmot would break off to swear something awful at every second word. We had met on the quay in Sydney, and he had an apron of sacking up to his chin, a big whip in his hand, a wagon driver, glad to do anything not to starve. That's what he had come down to. However, there he was, with his head inside the door on the girl's shoulder, as likely as not, officer of the watch. The helmsman, on giving his evidence afterwards, said that he shouted several times that the binnacle lamp had gone out. It didn't matter to him, because his orders were to sail her close. I thought it funny, he said, that the ship should keep on falling off in squalls, but I luffed her up every time as close as I was able. It was so dark I couldn't see my hand before my face, and the rain came in bucketfuls on my head. The truth was that at every squall the wind hauled aft a little, till gradually the ship came to be heading straight for the coast, without a single soul in her being aware of it. Wilmot himself confessed that he had not been near the standard compass for an hour. He might well have confessed. The first thing he knew was the man on the lookout shouting "Blue Murder" forward there. He tore his neck free, he says, and yelled back at him, "What do you say?" "I think I hear breakers ahead, sir," howled the man, and came rushing aft with the rest of the watch in the awfulest blinding deluge that ever fell from the sky, Wilmot says. For a second or so he was so scared and bewildered that he could not remember on which side of the gulf the ship was. He wasn't a good officer, but he was a seaman all the same. He pulled himself together in a second, and the right order sprang to his lips without thinking. They were to hard up with the helm and shiver the main and mizzen topsails. It seems that the sails actually fluttered. He couldn't see them, but he heard them rattling and banging above his head. No use! She was too slow in going off, he went on, his dirty face twitching, and the damned carter's whip shaking in his hand. She seemed to stick fast, and then the flutter of the canvas above his head ceased. At this critical moment the wind hauled aft again with a gust, filling the sails and sending the ship with a great way upon the rocks on her lee bow. She had overreached herself in her last little game. Her time had come, the hour, the man, the black night, the treacherous gust of wind, the right woman to put an end to her. The brute deserved nothing better. Strange are the instruments of Providence. There's a sort of poetical justice. The man in tweeds looked hard at me. The first ledge she went over stripped the false keel off of her. Rip! The skipper, rushing out of his berth, found a crazy woman in a red flannel dressing gown flying round and round the cuddy, screeching like a cockatoo. The next bump knocked the woman clean under the cabin table. It also started the stern post and carried away the rudder, and then that brute ran up a shelving, rocky shore, tearing her bottom out till she stopped short, and the foremast dropped over the bows like a gangway. "Anybody lost?" I asked. No one, unless that fellow Wilmot, answered the gentleman, unknown to Miss Blank, looking round for his cap. And his case was worse than drowning for a man. Everybody got ashore all right. Gale didn't come on till next day, dead from the west, and broke up that brute in a surprisingly short time. It was as though she had been rotten at heart. He changed his tone. Rain left off? I must get my bike and rush home to dinner. I live in Herne Bay. Came out for a spin this morning. He nodded at me in a friendly way and went out with a swagger. Do you know who he is, German? I asked. The North Sea pilot shook his head dismally. Fancy losing a ship in that silly fashion. Oh, dear, oh, dear, he groaned in lugubrious tones, spreading his damp handkerchief again like a curtain before the glowing grate. On going out, I exchanged a glance and a smile, strictly proper, with the respectable Miss Blank, barmaid of the Three Crows. And that story was The Brute by Joseph Conrad, from Great Short Stories of the World, selected by the editors of Reader's Digest. And now from The World's Shortest Stories, edited by Steve Moss. The Reunion by David Hoffman. In school, she'd been the closest thing to a girlfriend he ever had. Please keep in touch, he said when they graduated. Yeah, you too, she said. This reunion would be the first time they would talk in 5 years. Good to see you. Yeah, you too. Please keep in touch. Yeah, you too. And that was The Reunion by David Hoffman from The World's Shortest Stories, edited by Steve Moss. And that's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. If you miss a program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On Demand Podcasts. You can also listen to Sunsounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sunsounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me, and bye for now.